Good afternoon and welcome to the Atlantic Council. I'm Dennis Blair. I'm a board director of the Atlantic Council as well as chairman of Sasakawa USA, and it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to our first Commander's Series event this year, which is a conversation with the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Robert Neller. And we're also, as I understand it, live streaming this event, so welcome to wherever the camera is, or all of you who are watching online. And today's discussion continues the Council's long-standing flagship Commanders series, which is generously supported by Saab North America. Now, the role of today's service chief was defined in the Goldwater-Nichols legislation, the Act, Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986. And this legislation basically assigned to combatant commanders the job of planning, exercising, and operating joint forces in contingencies and in combat, and it assigned to the service chiefs the roles of organizing, training, and equipping their respective forces. Now, that's not a bad basic contrast, but things are really not that simple. And this legislation set up a series of tensions in the roles of the uniform military leaders that we've seen played out in various forms and solved in various ways since that time. The first tension is between supply and demand. The total force requirements of the combatant commanders to do their assigned missions with high confidence generally exceeds the total supply of the forces of the services, and so there have to be trade-offs and risk judgments made. It's not the case that heedless, ignorant combatant commanders ask for the moon. Rather, it's that the type of forces required for both the day-to-day and the contingency plans of different theaters are often quite different in type and in amount. The second tension is between the present and the future. Within fixed budgets, a service cannot generally satisfy all the demands for current ready forces, as well as making adequate investments in the equipment and in the people that will be needed for crises or conflicts 5, 10, 20 years in the future. And again, there have to be risks and trade-offs. And finally, there's a tension within strategy. Service chiefs do not have a direct assigned role in forming regional strategies for crisis or conflict. Requirements, plans, and decisions run from the combatant commander and his staff to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and his staff to the Secretary of Defense and the President. And although there are many informal ways for the service chiefs themselves and for their component commanders in each of the combatant commands to make inputs to the process, there is not a formal involvement. So like all imperfect organizational processes, the greater good is achieved only by the wisdom, maturity, mutual respect, initiative, and cooperation of individual leaders. They have to work within the system, do the roles that they are assigned, but they must also compensate for these structural flaws, these structural tensions, and they have to do it by common sense and communication across structural boundaries, and by keeping the greater good in mind. In my experience in senior joint assignments, the Marine Corps and its commandants have always been one of the most active and effective sets of leaders in this regard. Commandants over the years have managed to satisfy the requirements of regional commanders in ingenious and very effective ways. They have strong views and are able to satisfy both present and future requirements for their service, and they manage to stay deeply involved in forming regional strategies and helping combatant commanders make those in ways that will be smart and operationally savvy. And they always, and the Marine Corps is able to do this better than any, are able to preserve the traditions of their service while still being open to new ideas and being contributing members of the joint force. So General Neller follows a long line of exceptional service leaders, and we look forward to hearing from him how the Marine Corps is thinking about and dealing with the complex national security environment of 2018 and the probably more complex and more challenging security environment of the future. So it's my pleasure now to invite John Kaufman of Saab North America to the podium to introduce General Keller. John.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As the Admiral indicated, my name is John Kaufman from Saab North America. Well, just a quick and dirty on Saab here, just so you know. For more than 80 years, Saab has been at the forefront of technology and innovation, designing manufacturing products to enhance and enable national defense and to increase safety and security of the public. During that time, we've grown from a relatively small company dedicated to building airplanes for the Swedish government to a global provider of defense and security solutions. Here in the U.S., we've been active for more than 40 years, supplying the U.S. government and industry with our products and technology. Saab also places a great importance on international cooperation. As Europe faces evolving threats, it's crucial to maintain a strong relationship between the U.S. and Europe. As a global defense security company, Saab wants to support efforts to strengthen these transatlantic ties. By working together, we can promote peace and security for all in the future. And given today's global security situation, this effort is clearly more important than ever. That is also why our support of the Atlantic Council and our sponsorship of the Commander Series, which is now in its ninth year, are so valuable and important to us. Therefore, I'm very pleased to see that so many of you could make it here today, especially during spring break week, and it's a great honor for me to introduce a special guest for today, the Commandant of the United States Marine Corps, General Robert B. Neller. I could read through a long biography here for the General, but I think he would prefer that I dispense with that. But I would like to say one thing, and I've heard him say before that the prime directive is that, the Commandant ensures that your Marine Corps is the most ready when the nation is least ready. And I think there's a lot in that statement that's, quite accurate. But needless to say, the General has been in leadership positions at every level within the Marine Corps. He's a graduate of the Advanced Armor Course, the Marine Corps Command and Staff College, the NATO Defense College, the Armed Forces Staff College, and he holds a master's degree in human resource management from Pepperdine University. These are just a few of the highlights. General, we are very grateful that you're able to join us here today. Please join me in welcoming General Robert B. Neller to the stage.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kevin Barron. I'm the executive editor of Defense One. And as you all know, General Neller here, Commandant of the Marine Corps. I'm a Pentagon reporter. I have been for about 10 years on this beat specifically. And Defense One is the national security brand of the Atlantic Media Company, or sister to the Atlantic. You can catch us all online. I'm sure the General's an avid daily reader. He can tell you all about it. In addition to that bio or partial bio we heard, I just learned backstage a key point that General Neller is a Trekkie. He's a big Star Trek man. Why? You said specifically you're a Captain Picard guy.
I think that Star Trek is a leadership show. I think it talks about the future. I think there's different versions. I've been on about four or five different versions of Star Trek. My favorite, as I told you, is Star Trek Next Generation with Jean-Luc Picard as the captain of the Enterprise. So I've always enjoyed watching it. I thought it was, it's a little hokey sometimes, but we talked a lot about modernization, technology, but I think it's above everything else, it's a leadership show because you always find that the crew and the captain are put in some sort of moral, ethical, operational dilemma, which I find interesting.
I just thought that had to come out for.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yes, so there's definitely something to tweet about.
Yeah.
No matter what else we talk about.
My children are going to thank you for that. Although they already know.
Good, good. So I thought we would start wide and work our way down to some topics, and I told the General's staff, I'd want to start us off by talking a little bit about these times. that we're in and what it's like for you to be a service chief in these times we're in. And when I say these times, I really mean all of it. I mean, we just walked past a new screen where the news is breaking right now of the latest development about Stormy Daniels and what's, you know, occupying the White House's mind. And if it's not that, it's the latest development on North Korea or the Kim Jong-un talks or Vladimir Putin's latest threat or the president's reaction to it. I can't recall such an active time where national security issues are just bouncing off the news daily, daily, daily. How is that affecting your life as commandant, especially in the last year with this new administration? What changes, what do you worry about, and what do you hear when you go out and speak to your troops, to Marines around the world?
I don't really think it's changed much of anything. I mean, Secretary Mattis, since he assumed his position, has been pretty clear, and I think he's right. Our lane is the defense lane. You know, as Admiral Blair said, the service chief's job as a service chief is to provide trained and ready forces to combatant commanders. And we're there to provide those trained and ready forces so that the nation is secure globally. And that's our lane. And what happens outside of that is of interest, but this should not ever distract you from what you're trying to do. So we have 186,000 active duty Marines and about 39,000 reserve Marines at any one time. You know, a quarter to a third of them are deployed and their families are at home. And our responsibility is to ensure that they're out there with the proper gear, the proper training, and they can do their mission and can return home. So anything other than that is of mild interest. And so when I go talk to Marines, you know, I understand that they're out there and they see all this. And I remind them, say, look, you took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic. Do your job. Do your job. And don't bring, we don't have a place. We're here to defend the nation. That's what we do. We're the Defense Department. We're the United States Marine Corps, as was stated by Mr. Kaufman, ready when the nation is least ready. And anything that distracts us from that is quite frankly, not beneficial. So focus on the game, give it your best every day, and then the rest of everything else will work itself out.
And what's the response? So, and I'm thinking specifically in the last couple months, the president went out and spoke to Marines, and there was a lot of reaction to that, specifically to him, or to the idea of it being a politicized event in front of troops. You know, I'm a reporter going after the press again. Do the Marines, do they hear your message, or does it bother you that they're applauding those political lines?
You know, I mean, they were in an event, and they responded to the president. He's the commander-in-chief. You know, that was an individual event, but you know, what I've seen when I talk to them and when I see them in training, they're singularly focused on what they're supposed to do. They understand the mission. This is not just an all-volunteer force, this is an all-recruited and all-retained force. I mean, and they have a responsibility, and I remind them of that, and they respond. I think we're in a good place. But I do remind them of where they are and their role in the United States, that their Department of Defense and their job is defense. They're United States Marines. And there's a certain expectation with that. And we all have to do our best every day to live up to that expectation, which is not a low bar.
So at the higher level, the planning level, and we'll get to planning for all these contingencies around the world, but one of the newer developments in the same vein has been this perceived crackdown, or not perceived, a reported crackdown on speaking to the press, public engagements. It came out a couple weeks ago on the Air Force side, but I wanted to ask you, speaking just for your service, is there a similar, you know, give us the realities to some of the myths. I mean, I've heard everything from, you know, there's a limit to only one 4-star a day should be talking to the press, all the way down to individual engagements being canceled, and whether or not it's either from the Air Force or it's from the White House or from Dunford or none of it. Tell the public what's going on behind the scenes behind this.
I'm not, I don't, I don't feel that I'm been restrained, and I'm not restraining any Marines. I mean, the media is part of American life. This is a democratic society. You're going to write a story. And I think we're compelled and should be able to convey to you our version of that story. And I've never told a Marine they could and couldn't speak. In fact, the best spokesperson for the Marine Corps, I want you to talk to our young Marines. I mean, they're outstanding young men and women, and they're smart enough to know when to stay in their lane. So, but I have not been told one way or the other what to do or not to do with the media. So we'll continue to engage, because I want the American people to know what their Marine Corps is doing, because I think we're doing a lot of really great, incredible stuff, and they should be proud of it.
All right. So sticking with the news, the latest development, and then we'll get to the regional stuff, was the new policy on transgender troops. Give us your thoughts on that policy, or your input as much as you can, on this change of where previously open service was the rule, and now there are limitations to that. Did you support that change?
You know, the advice I gave to the Secretary of the Navy and the SecDef is privileged communication between us. I mean, I read the Secretary's policy. The President said that they defer to the decision of the Secretary of Defense and the Director of Homeland Security. I believe this is all still under litigation. And so, in the meantime, until the courts decide what the rules are going to be, I think we'll just leave it at that. So there are any number of personnel in the Marine Corps. It fluctuates, you know, it's not a large number, but I've met with some of them, and they're out there serving.
Some transgender troops.
There are. Yes. And so, you know, they're out there, and as long as they, like any Marine, they're expected to maintain the standards and perform according to the requirements, and as long as they do so, until we hear otherwise, they'll continue to wear this uniform and serve their country. So we'll see what happens with the other decisions. I know there's a lot of litigation going on, and I'm not going to speculate on that. In the meantime, they're United States Marines, and they'll do their job.
Okay. I'll remind the audience we will open to questions in the latter half of this discussion, so keep them in mind. Let's go around the world a little bit. I was fortunate enough to go out with General Votel to CENTCOM in January. Mm-hmm. And we went through Iraq, went up to Syria, went through Afghanistan. So I'd like to talk about all those conflicts and the future of counterterrorism specifically. How about we start with Afghanistan? There's a new strategy. Some question how new it is, or if it's a little bit more of just putting a little bit of foot on the gas. But out there, the officers that I met with, and we were a little bit more focused on Air Force and that new expanded mission, but there was a lot of hope, and this is what I wrote out of it, and got a lot of strong reaction to that article. That, you know what, here we go again. It's year whatever team, mm-hmm. and this is just more of the same. And here's another crop of up and coming young generals who just don't know, or they've been drinking the Kool-Aid so long, combined with low public opinion back home of staying in these wars, and a little bit of unsurety of what the president actually wants. What's your generic take on Afghanistan? But why should Americans think the U.S. needs to stay as engaged as it is, much less ramp up the fight again?
Well, I think it would be easy to say, hey, you know, we just pull the plug and leave, but I think we went into Afghanistan because it was a safe haven for those that attacked our country on 9/11. And I think you could make the case, if we were not there present and support the Afghan government, that could happen again. There's also other forces. I mean, I know I've never served. I've visited Afghanistan multiple times, but I've never served there, and it's different. I mean, I've served in Iraq, so my ability to make completely without having served there and lived it day to day, so I'm somewhat guarded about making it. But in talking to the folks that I know that have been there, and we have a Marine force back in Helmand, I think it's different. I think we don't have 100,000 plus Americans there. The number is much, much smaller. Our involvement in the day to day tactical activities of the Afghans is out on the street is minimal, and we're facilitating them doing the fighting, and I think they're having some success. You know, we're at the beginning of the fighting season for this year, so we'll have to see what happens as we go through. Afghanistan is going to potentially have an election later this year, and that'll be a telltale sign as to how what the political climate is there amongst the people. But I think it is different. I think the support of the Air Force, the support of their counterterrorism services, the way we're doing the advising, not doing for them, but advising them and let them do the fighting, they're having some success. That said, I think the most important thing is, you know, the offer of President Ghani for reconciliation and for Afghan Taliban to come in. And that's going to be, you know, I mean, there's got to be a political resolution. There is no, you're not just going to fight this thing forever. And I think that's probably why there may be some, you know, concern on a part of people. We've been there since 2001.
But the strategy is essentially to, we're going to fight them until they give up and come to the
table. No, the Afghans
table.
Are going to fight them, and we're going to help the Afghans, right. and we've got to bring them in.
They're American sugar pullers on the ground.
Yeah, but they're not with normal, with conventional Afghan formations. They're out there, but, you know, we're not at the point of contact. At least the Marines aren't. I know how the Marines are conducting the operation, and they're not. CT forces, that's different. But at some point, I mean, we'll have to take a look at this. And I'm, as a member of the Joint Chiefs, you know, I'm going to take a look at where we are with this. But there's got to be reconciliation or political resolution of this thing. And we're going to have to get other players involved with this, other regional players that have equity there. I mean, and the Afghans themselves, they go, hey, look, there's got to be a better way. You just can't live in a constant state of war. For many of them, probably maybe their entire adult lives. There's a better way to do this, and I think that's what we're going to try to convey, working with the Afghan government.
You see, I mean, I'm trying to gauge how optimistic you are, because, and I'll play devil's advocate, this sounds a lot like what we've heard for all these years. Well, we need political resolution, the Afghans need to do it, they need to do it themselves, but they're not. Hasn't been political resolution.
I understand, and we're going to see how this goes. So okay. I think, you know, how long is it going to take? I mean, you could say we've been there 18 years, we've been there 1 year at a time 18 times. And I think this is different. And so this is going to be the Afghans trying to figure this out, and we have to facilitate their success to the best of our ability. So we'll, you know, my own personal view is, I mean, I'm gonna ask our commanders that are there, okay, where are we? You know, there's gotta be, at some point, gotta be some commitment to getting political reconciliation with the Taliban. And we're not gonna do that just through fighting alone. That's gotta come through Afghan to Afghan discussions and other leverage from other people.
So let's switch over to Iraq, where you do have plenty of experience. And a similar kind of question about the state of Iraq and the future of it. Right now, we're being told the ISIS war might be near over, but it's not over yet, even in Iraq. We'll hold off on Syria for a minute. But that the future of that country is once again at a new beginning. The influence of the Iranians and versus the Saudis is all on the table. Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of the chances of Iraq having a better start this time around than the last time?
Well, if we were sitting here 2 years ago, we would have said that ISIS was, you know, controlled certain percentage of the country. They're outside the gates of Baghdad. They had taken control of Ramadi and Fallujah, and now that's not the case. And Iraq has more or less restored the territorial integrity of their country. Does that mean that ISIS is gone? No, they've gone to ground, they're out in the desert, or they're splinter cells, they're still there. But the Iraqi security forces, again, they regained control of their country. We facilitated their success. But, you know, to do that, they paid the price, both in casualties and in destruction of, you know, major cities. So there's a lot of other political factors. I'm not going to speculate on that, but the United States has been there to support Prime Minister Abadi. He's up for election here, I think, in May. Mm-hmm. And we'll see who wins the election, and I think that'll tell what the future But in the meantime, we'll continue to stay there because they've asked us to stay there, and along with about 40 other countries, part of a coalition that are there to help them train and sustain and reestablish security. So it's not perfect, but it's certainly tactically better. And we'll see long term. You know, Iraq is a sovereign country. They're going to do what's best in their interest. And so we're there to support them, and we'll see if their recognition of our contribution to them reestablishing the sovereignty of their country is, you know, what's that worth. And obviously there are other players involved, as you mentioned, in the region, and Iran is part of this whole thing, and with their involvement there and in Syria and in other places.
You know, the when we were in Baghdad, we met with three elite generals from the Army, CTS, the FedPol. And one of the things that they were stressing was what to do about the PMF, and in the aftermath of the fighting, just a little bit of surprise, were very defensive of them and said, "Look, even if they were backed by the Iranians and the rest of us are backed by the Americans, it doesn't matter. We're all Iraqis and we all fought a common enemy. And now there's a plan or there's a desire to turn that into a legitimate organization that's part of the Iraqi security structure." Is that something that's concerning to you, or encouraging, or doesn't matter?
You know, there's different. Well, when I was there, there were no PMF. I was in Anbar, even though they were Shia members of the Iraqi army. There were not PMF forces operating in Anbar at that time. So it's different, and I can understand they fought together, and if they're trying to reconcile within their own culture, I mean, I think we have some concerns about that, because some of those groups have taken American casualties. They've killed our folks. And again, we'll have to wait and see what politically happens. But I think it bears watching, and then we'll see what the outcome is. But there clearly are some of those groups that are not friends of the United States.
The other group in the region that is by far more friendly to the United States would be the Kurds. And between the Peshmerga and the SDF, what is your feeling about the I won't say complaints, I'll say the concerns coming out of their leaders right now, who are very worried that the U.S. support for them is precarious. It's limited to the ISIS war and only to that ISIS mission, that frankly, something they're being hung out to dry in favor for geopolitics and what Turkey wants. And it's now put the entire ISIS campaign at risk if some of those fighters feel they have to go defend against, you know, Turkey because the U.S. won't do it for them or something like that.
You know, again, I have not been over there for a number of years. I'm not going to speculate on what is or isn't going to happen with the Kurds or the SDF. It's very complicated. We got a NATO ally, Turkey, who has concerns about certain groups, and they affiliate them and maybe differently politically than we do. But we asked a certain group to help us fight ISIS, which was our common enemy among all the players, and they did that. So I know General Votel has some feelings about this, but I think when you ask somebody to do something and they do it, then you have to kind of maintain a certain level of loyalty to them. But at the same time, you know, they're not all Kurds. I mean, some percentage of the SDF are Arabs. They live there. I mean, there are Syrian people living in what we know as Syria. So it's much more complicated, I think, because of the involvement of others, because of whether it's the Iranians, whether it be Hezbollah, whether it be the Russians, whether it be the Turks. And again, there's a diplomatic process. Going through Geneva, it would be good. There's no way militarily this is going to get solved. It's going to have to be a diplomatic solution where the diplomats sit down and they hammer out some sort of an agreement that's going to take compromise on everybody's part. And that's always challenging in that part of the world. But in the meantime, you know, our forces are there. They're there. They know what their mission is, and they've got the inherent right of self-defense, and they'll do what they have to do to support those people that we're supporting.
Part of why I ask about the Kurds, and you said it yourself about, you know, what loyalty is owed to someone, to some force that helps your mission, because it relates to the future of not just the ISIS, but the counterterrorism fight, and I'm thinking geographically, spreading across the MENA into these much larger geographic areas. Mm-hmm. And I've asked others about this, and I want to put it to you. If the idea is that the U.S. is either fighting or helping local forces fight to get rid of ungoverned spaces, to create better conditions, the generic counterterrorism mission, if it's spreading across North Africa, the U.S. doesn't have enough drones for that, doesn't have enough Marines, doesn't have enough troops, and some decisions are going to be had to be made. What discussions do you go through right now about that future, not just for the Marines, start there if you will, but for the country, and how do you see this playing out in the next few years?
Well, ISIS is the common enemy. ISIS is the threat, and they have a desire to harm the homeland, and so we have to be focused on them. And you're right, I mean, the world's a big place, and that's why part of the strategy that the National Defense Strategy is building alliances and partnerships. So we don't have enough capacity to do it all by ourselves, and nor should we want to do it by ourselves. I mean, we want to, but we do have enough capacity to help other nations develop their own capabilities, their own counterterrorism force, their own security forces, and I think we're working to do that, not by ourselves, but with other partners in the region, whether it be the French, the British, the Italians, or anybody else, or working with Nigeria, or working with the West African countries, or anybody else. So, because at the end of the day, we can't stay there. They probably don't want us to stay there. We don't have the ability to stay there. They're going to have to develop their own capability. But we've got enough capacity to help them develop that, and that's part of the strategy. And then we'll have to figure out how we move those capabilities around. And you're right, but ISIS is a cancer, and they need to be destroyed.
But why can't you stay there? Why shouldn't they? These countries want Americans to stay there. Isn't this
to stay there? It's a matter of relativity. I mean, we have embassies. We've got security cooperation teams. We can train them. We can episodically visit them. But we don't need to stay there. At some point, I mean, they've got to be able to. Again, it varies from country to country. Some countries are much more capable; they develop capability faster. But you know, and that's part of the tension that Admiral Blair mentioned, is that you've got capacity and you've got requirement, and so you're always balancing that out. And that's what the combatant commanders do. And then the job of the service chief is to provide that capability to them. And then we weigh those discussions in the tank with the chairman and make recommendations to the secretary.
Right, and you mentioned the NDS. So when you look at the NDS and at the current budget and the projections ahead, is it adequate for the mission being asked, at least of the Marines? And just, again, thinking of across Africa, for example, and the counterterrorism mission.
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it's a lot of money, the current appropriation for 18, and hopefully Congress will see fit to approve the appropriation for 19. That's a lot of money. Some of it's going to go to operations and maintenance and things to do that. We're looking at certain force structures to retain a capability to advise and assist and build capacity in foreign countries that we haven't had in the past. So this is not something that's going to go away. So is there enough money there? Yes, I think there is. I think we stated what our requirement was, and the Congress voted us the money, actually more than what we asked for. And so our job now is to spend it wisely and create the capabilities that we need to keep America safe.
We'll talk a little bit about what's in the budget and what your priorities are, either this year or through your larger, you know, Marine Corps Force 2025 plans.
Well, the first thing was to improve our readiness, and there was a down payment on that last year in FY17. So we're working to improve our readiness, particularly with our aviation. This budget allows us to accelerate our modernization, particularly in aviation. So we're in the process of replacing a remodel type series aircraft. We've got a ground vehicle strategy that's currently evolving, and the number of Marines will go up, particularly to provide us a capacity to do more cyber and information operations and electronic warfare. So that budget is more than adequate for that, and I'm confident that we'll be able to show that by spending this, we achieve this increase in our readiness. So there are still capacities that we think, if you look at the future fight or you try to project or envision what the future is going to bring, the Marine operational concept posits a question, or actually the problem is that we're currently, and that was 2 years ago, not organized, trained, and equipped to fight a peer adversary in 2025. I think we're making progress toward being able to do that, but there are still certain capability areas, whether it be information operations, which includes electronic warfare, long-range precision fires, protective maneuver, air defense. We struggle today with the ability to engage. You know, we haven't had a, you think about enemy air attack, you think about jets and bombers and stuff. I mean, I think the real future enemy air attack is going to be swarming drones. And because it's cheap and it's easy and we know we can do it. And our ability right now to take that on is something we're working on, and we're going as fast as we can. So
why is that a Marine mission? Would that be
something? Well, it's not a Marine mission. It's every mission. I think every force on the ground or every force at sea or any base is potentially under, could be under attack of drones. I mean, you're going to see drones, you know, they're going to fly in airspace. They're going to be flying all over the place, and they're very inexpensive, and their autonomy and the ability to fly a planned route. And if they start to be weaponized, I think, there's something that we're going to have to deal with, and it's here now, and we're working on it, but we've got to come up with some better solutions. Part of it's a policy thing here in the homeland, but overseas, you know, we've seen ISIS, you know, you think about ISIS aviation, it's a groups of drones and things like that. So that's a different thing of air defense that we have. When you think of air defense, you think theater ballistic missiles and enemy bombers and all that. Now we're talking, you know, small drones that come in groups, and you're going to have to be able to deal with that.
So when you look at where Marines are being tasked right now, some of the places around the world we're hearing are fairly new, or they were old, but they're new again. Mm-hmm. Places like Norway, mm-hmm. And out in Asia. And even news that there's going to be an increase of the, I guess, the number of Marines in rotation in Australia than before. How are you planning for all these contingencies on the fly when, just in the last couple of years, the Marine Corps has gone from being, you know, the force in Fallujah on the ground and in Afghanistan, then supposedly was had time to take a big step back and then repurpose itself. We even started hearing phrases like, if it's every Marine a rifleman, now it's every Marine a cyberman or a cyber warrior. And yet, almost it seems on the turn of a dime, here we are again being asked to be ready in a place like Norway. How are you handling these shifts in the geographic landscape?
Well, you know, the Marine hymn says, in every climate place, right?
Yes, it
and
does.
So, you know, we say that we're the nation's force and readiness, ready when the nation's least ready, that we're going to be able to operate across the spectrum of conflict, which includes geography and climatology. We're back in Norway because the Norwegians offer us an opportunity. We have a long history with Norway. We have still have equipment set there. And we needed to get back in the cold weather business. And if you want to go do cold weather, you need to go with the people that are the experts. And they're the experts. And our Royal Marine partners train up there, and they're very good in cold weather. So we had opportunity to go back, and we took it. It's a small number of Marines. The number of Marines in the Pacific has been, you forget, you know, the number of Marines in the Pacific were set, and then when we went to Desert Shield, or not to OIF, and then to OEF, you know, there were years and years and years, there were very few Marines in the Pacific. We're just back to the status quo to what we were before. There's been an agreement with Australia to provide a force down there 6 months out of the year, and the aspiration was to achieve a certain number, and we're incrementally working our way to that point. So we still have enough capacity to do what we need to do with the Navy as part of amphibious ready groups and marine expeditionary units, and we're able to meet the COCOM requirements. So the depth tempo is high. I wish it were a little bit better, not because I don't want Marines to deploy, because when 62% of your force is 25 years old or younger, they want to go and do stuff. They didn't join to sit home on their sea bag. But we've got a career force, and some of them, it would be good. Back when I was a younger officer, it was 18 months home for 6 months deployed. We've been closer to 12 months home for 6 months deployed. And that decreases your time to get ready, decreases the time to learn your trade, to learn your business. And we would like to get out to closer to 18 months. Some units are there, some are not. But the one way to do that is you got two ways, make the force bigger or you decrease the requirements. So we're trying to figure out a way that we can cover down what we need to cover down, take advantage of being aboard ship a little bit more, and work with the Navy to get more maritime-based force packages out there and get out of land-based positions. But right now, 186,000 plus or minus Marines is where we're going to be, and we want to make those Marines the best and capable Marines we can.
For FY19, is that the number?
Yeah.
That's right. So I want to open the floor to questions from the audience. I know we have a few here, so I'll start right in the middle with our familiar face, Otto.
Good afternoon, General. We had a defense writer at breakfast this morning with General Goldfein, and he told us about that you spent the day yesterday with him, Air Force Marine talks. We're all familiar with, you know, the Marine Corps Army talks, and of course Marine Corps Navy Board. But I was a little surprised that you're getting together with the Air Force. What was the discussion there, and how often do you meet with your Air Force counterparts these days?
Well, the meeting we had yesterday with the Air Force was the first time we'd met since 2011. So one of the first things we decided is that we're not going to wait 7 more years to do this again. In fact, we're probably going to come up with some sort of a staff-level board quarterly where we'll meet and talk about some of the common things that we discussed yesterday. And, you know, obviously F-35 is one thing where we have a common focus on the price point of that airplane, sustainability of that airplane, logistics of that airplane. And we kind of went from there. So we talked everything from space to cyber to close air support to command and control to security of bases and stations. And so it was a really good day. I think a lot of times you sit down with somebody that, you know, you might think we don't have a lot in common with the Air Force, but you know, we filled the time and we could have spent more time there. And so we're going to get together on a more regular basis to try to address some of these things, to include, you know, air defense and we talked about defense against unmanned aircraft. So it was a great day. General Goldfein is a great partner and the air staff, so we'll continue to develop that relationship. And I think that's the same for all the services. We're in this together. The joint force is the joint force. I mean, it's not going to be the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard is going to go out there singularly and be successful in competition or on the battlefield. I mean, jointness is something we work really hard to develop, and it's a perishable thing. And so I think all the chiefs and the chairman and the vice chairman and the co-counsel, we've all stacked hands on, we're going to continue to work on developing our joint capability.
Defense against unmanned vehicles, Air Force wants to control the air. What good does that do for
Well, I don't really care who shoots them down. I just want them to go away. And, you know, if we have to do that, I mean, there's a layer of defense. And, you know, General Goldfein wants to say he doesn't want any soldier or Marine look up in the air and wonder, you know, whose aircraft that is. Problem is with a drone, you can't hear it. So, but we've got, there are a number of scenarios that I'm not going to talk about here, but where we have common concern about ability of airspace being penetrated by those things.
Okay. So right on the, across the aisle.
Sir, George Nicholson with the Global Special Operations Forces Foundation. 2 years ago, when you spoke here, one of the first things that you said was the biggest threat the Marine Corps is looking at in the future is our dependence upon GPS and SATCOM. The next week, I was with Admiral Richardson, and he said exactly the same thing. I've sat in several meetings with the Air Force and brought that up with their space people, and they said, they don't need to worry about that. We've got that under control. Any updates of which, do you still have those same concerns?
We spent some time talking about space yesterday and its ability to support the network. And they made a strong case about maybe not today, but in the future, where the risk might not be as great as we think. That said, and I heard what they said, but if we had to go tonight, I have concerns about our ability not that the network is going to go down. I mean, I could envision, you know, we don't talk about fighting in space. When I say fighting in space, I'm not talking about human beings in space, per se. But the old adage of, you know, see the battlefield. I mean, I learned that in Army school, see the battlefield. So if you want to see the battlefield, you got to have the high ground, and the high ground today is space. So I have some concerns about our ability, not just the Marine Corps, but the Joint Force, to be able to do the stuff that they need to do. I don't think it'll all go away, and I think it'll come back episodically. But if I were going to fight somebody that I knew had a requirement to be able to do communications or GPS or crypto timing or all the stuff we get out of space, I mean, that would be the first place. I consider it's a critical. That's the thing that we have to protect. You talk about centers of gravity. So I got a friendly center of gravity. I got to protect command and control. I got a critical vulnerability. It's my command and control and the way it's set up. So how do you protect it and then mitigate it if it's degraded? How do you make it resilient enough? And so we talked about that, and it was a good discussion. And in our training, we're working on that and every time we go to the field. And part of it's simple. I mean, I know the Navy is doing a lot of stuff where they reduce their signature or eliminate it altogether, the best of their ability. I mean, exercises now, we'll just go out there and, because we've raised a generation of officers and a force that thinks that you're going to sit in a stationary COC and they're going to watch streaming video and going to have big flat screen TVs. You know, and as opposed to the way I grew up, where I was underneath a poncho with a red lens flashlight in my mouth with the rain beating down, listening to a Prick 77. Okay, and somehow we managed to get from A to B. I wouldn't want that. I don't think we're going to get to that point. But we're working what we call, what's the baseline comm that we're going to need? What can we rely on all the time? And then everything above that becomes a benefit.
Well, give us a little more detail to that. I mean, how are you changing whether it's training and the Marines and or Navy?
It's training. I think it's, you know, HF radio, certain radios, certain antenna forms, certain waveforms, certain just the ability. I mean, commander's intent. When, you know, the Marine Corps operates on maneuver warfare. Maneuver warfare is based on explicit trust between commanders and where the senior commander says, this is the NCAA I want. And if you can achieve that, you don't necessarily need to be on the radio or given a sit rep every 30 seconds telling them, hey, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. Well, just, I told you what to do. When you get there, call me. And so I think you can very easily, it's kind of like your cell phone. I mean, how many times a day do you check your phone?
I'm a journalist, so it's killing me. So I haven't checked it as I've been sitting here.
Okay, so you, obviously you have a problem. So, so
there's lots of problems.
But there's a lot. But I mean, so you can very easily create dependency. And I think, you know, we've got to train ourselves and convince ourselves and show ourselves, hey, I can do this. I don't need to be transmitting all the time.
Is the force over-reliant on communications?
And I'd say that it can, yeah. And I think we're trying to show them that they don't necessarily have to do it. I mean, there's some stuff. I mean, there's some nets are more important. There's some nets you got to protect. If I'm going to do fire support, I got to have fire support. I mean, there's other nets I can probably accept a certain degradation, or I can go without it. But you don't need to be, you know, we don't have to have perfect comm, and you shouldn't expect to have perfect comm all the time.
That alone, I think, is an extraordinary thing to hear these days, from anyone in the U.S. military, where everything seems to be everything that's desired. Every piece of hardware is so exquisite, and has to be redundant, and has to have backups, yeah. And has to have multiple, you know, levels and layers. I mean, you know, an operator doesn't go out without you know,
that's true,
multiple levels of comms and drones up ahead, and forget about big warfare and Navy ships and what you're talking about as far as shutting down entire systems in you know, high-end warfare.
Well, but if you expect that your adversary has the potential capability to do that to you and you don't train to it, I think you'd be remiss in your responsibilities. I mean, Secretary Mattis the other day had a great, he called it the primitivization of communications.
Hmm.
I mean, we're back to, I mean, I know lights work. I got flags, I got horns, I got pyrotechnics, I got mirrors. I can run wire. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I can do. And if you train to it, is it optimal? No, it's not.
But it's necessary now.
But it's something you have to consider. And it makes the training problem harder because now I got to do all that, or at least consider all that, plus all this other stuff.
It's the unanticipated result of high technology. Back to the audience here, the shirt in the front had his hand open.
Name's Dave Onspach, retired government engineer. I'm just throwing this out there. What would it be like if, for example, I'm just asking, if the Army and the Marine Corps were merged together, run on Marine Corps type lines, do you see that as being an advantage to military role in American taxpayer? I'm just throwing it out there. It seems like what the Marine Corps does, especially in Afghanistan, has a lot in common with what the Army does. So I'm just wondering whether there's a advantage to somehow merging the two roles together. Thanks.
Well, at least he didn't say merging the Marines into the Army.
You know, I, as a son of a soldier and a graduate of Army school, I like our Army. I like big Army. Army, I mean, there's a million soldiers in the Army, in the Guard, in the Reserve, in the active Army. I like big Army. I like big heavy junk units. I mean, so I think the nation has a requirement for a land force, a land power like the Army. And they have a requirement for a middleweight force that comes from the sea like the Marine Corps. So we do more together. I mean, we've been on the battlefield together since 2003. And many of our even senior officers now grew up fighting with soldiers. So that really helps us. We don't always agree on everything. But I think when you talk, the Army talks about multi-domain battle, we talk about Marine, it's the same thing. We see the fight the same way, that it's different than it was. And so, we resolve those differences. We have a quarterly Army Marine Corps board, and we talk about requirements. And I think the one thing we can't do is if we have a common requirement or a common thing that we want to do together, then we need to stay as close together because it saves the taxpayers money and we can come up with a single requirement. But I mean, I'm very happy with General Milley and the United States Army, and I believe he would say the same thing about the Marine Corps.
You know, these are legitimate questions. A few years ago, there were some, you know, fairly serious op-eds being run about ending the Air Force. And now we're talking about a new Space Corps or Space Command or of some kind, a whole entire service. So these questions come up.
No, and I think, you know, we should always be looking to get better. We should, if there's a better way to do this. But I don't, you know, in that case, I think the United States wants an Army and they want a Marine Corps. And we have to prove that we're worthy of and live up to the expectations of what they expect from us.
Okay, right on the far end.
General Justin Katz, Inside Defense. I understand you were in California last week for the technology demonstration and
tax. I was not. I watched it. I just saw some pictures of it, but I was not present.
Oh, you weren't?
I was not, no. It was some other short, handsome-looking guy that was out there.
Okay. Well, I'll still throw this out there. I guess could you talk about the future technology you see as being important for the Marine Corps' future mission, obviously future technology being the key role of ANTAX?
Well, we're doing a lot of experimentation, and we invite vendors and people with ideas to come to certain events. This one was involved, I think, operations in urban terrain, and they brought, you know, different things and vehicles and ISR, and you know, we're basically out there And we use Marines as kind of our jury. And we let them see the technology, and we let them play with it, and we let them use it, and we go, okay, what do you, you know, and then they're pretty cut and dry. I mean, it's like, yeah, this is junk. Or, you know, this actually was pretty cool, and this is how I would use it. So we're simply trying to do two things. One, see what's out there within the business world and what might be of use to us. And we're also trying to get our Marines exposed to what's going on in technology. And it doesn't cost us a whole lot because everybody shows up hoping. There's a lot of great thinking going on out there. And I mean, there's other areas that we're still, you know, we did that every time we do an amphibious exercise. Every training event becomes an experiment. And so we look forward to anybody coming with any ideas they have that we can take a look at. And we share those with the other services. But so anything specifically, I haven't heard anything back or got a report back that there was these types of things that they saw, but I'm sure there'll be something.
Back in the center, a little hand raised. There
you go. Sean Snow with Marine Corps Times. The Marine Corps is beefing up its presence in Australia. I was wondering if you could explain why that decision was made, what the Marines are going to be doing there, and if the decision was made because of any particular threat or any particular country in mind. Thanks.
So when the decision was made for Marine Response Force to go to Darwin many years ago, there was a goal of a certain number of Marines. And then every year for the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, we've incrementally increased the number of Marines. So this year we added an artillery unit and increased the number of aircraft. So it was done as part of an agreement with Australia. And we'll go there for 6 months and we're going to train. So it wasn't done with any other than we have an agreement with them. And it's that time of year. And from April to October, we go to Darwin and we go to Robinson Barracks. And then we use the training area down there. And then at the end of that period, that force will redeploy and go home. I mean, it's nothing more complicated than that.
All right, there you go, right in the front. So we're within 10 minutes. We'll try to rapid fire a couple as we wrap up.
Thank you. I'm Satoshi Nishihata from the Liberty Magazine and Happy Science Group in Japan. We always appreciate the existence of Marine Corps in Japan, mm-hmm. and my organization has been always telling the government, Japanese government and media, to appreciate more the existence of a Marine Corps in Okinawa. My question is about the situation in the Korean Peninsula has been evolving, and you once said a war in the Korean Peninsula could be really tough comparing the Game of Thrones. And could you give us an update and your current take about the prospect of Korean Peninsula, especially regarding President Trump is supposed to meet with Kim Jong-un by May. Thank you.
Well, we're in the middle of semi-annually, there's a training exercise with the Korean, the ROCs, and other UN. I mean, the armistice in Korea was done under the auspices of the United Nations. So we're there and we're doing our training, but I think everybody is hopeful that these talks. I saw today that your prime minister had offered to meet with the ROCs or with the North Koreans. I saw that President Moon was planning to meet with Kim Jong-un, that Kim Jong-un was recently in China. So, hey, nobody wants to go to war. I mean, that's failure. So I think we're all, you know, we'll sit there. I mean, our job is to provide leverage for our diplomats, and the diplomats got the ball, and we're all rooting for them to come up with some sort of a solution that's going to take what has been a very dangerous, unstable situation and fix it. But I appreciate your comments about the fact that and that most people don't realize we are in Okinawa and in mainland Japan based on a treaty between our two countries for the defense of Japan. That's why we're there. But thank you for saying that.
I know a lot about the Okinawa issue as a former Stars and Stripes reporter, but what you just said about nobody wants war, but what about limited strikes? Is that something that's still discussed on the as it has been in the past six months or a year?
You know, I'm not going to talk about anything that's been discussed. You know, right now we're in a place where I think the Secretary Mattis has said and the Chairman has said, hey, look, you know, the purpose of the United States military is to create space for our diplomats and for the president. That's our job. So there's space now. So let's all hope that they're successful.
Okay, so this slide right here, this gentleman.
Thank you. Sir, my name is Ross Duckworth. I'm a defense consultant here in town, presently advising Estonia. And I'm retired from the United States Marine Corps. Thank you for coming today, and thank you for your candor. You are definitely not from the canned goods section. You don't have as much time in uniform as Winfield Scott, but you're getting close. You and I entered active duty the same year. I wonder if you would comment on how individual Marines have changed since you were a company grade officer. Not the Marine Corps, but individual Marines, for the better or for the worse. And if I could point you in a couple directions, one would be attention to detail, and another would be respect for rank and the willingness to carry out orders without saying, sir, can we talk about this? Mm-hmm. Or, sir, I had a better idea than yours, so I did it differently. Thank you.
You know, when we came in, it was the end of Vietnam, and the 1st Platoon I stood in front of was 2nd Platoon, Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. They had just had a mutiny 2 weeks before I got there.
You said mutiny?
A mutiny. They had a group of Marines that refused to come out of the barracks in the morning. And as I walked down to, I was told that. So when I went down to meet my platoon sergeant, now retired Sergeant Major Joe Hull, and we met and we talked, and I looked over the Marines in the platoon. About 50% high school grads, three squad leaders, Sergeant Bacon, Sergeant Douglas and Corporal Thomas, average GT of about 69. They were not stupid men. They were not educated. But the Marines were. It was a different Marine Corps. We didn't have any money. There was no air conditioning. The gear was old. A lot of, you know, still Korean War stuff, and we went to the field every week, and we trained hard, and we did the best we could. So we, you know, kind of grew up, expect nothing, get less. That way you're never disappointed. And then in the 80s, came back, and, going to Camp Pendleton, a lot of discipline problems, a lot of drug problems. We weren't doing your analysis. But in the middle of that, even from then, there were a lot of really good Marines. Tough Marines, tough kids that grew up with nothing. But there were way too many that they couldn't handle authority. They weren't disciplined. And we were not a combat ready force. As we've gone through since that time, I think we've become, as we've increased the requirements, General Wilson said, I'm going to go to 75% high school grads, and we're going to take a PFT, and then we're going to do this. And then now we're up to 99.9% high school grads. The physical standards are much, 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 much higher. Are they different? Are the young men and women different? Did they ask more questions? Sure, but I would assure you, if I took you out to a training range and you watched them run range 400 or you watch an infantry unit, you would be amazed at their fitness, their discipline. I don't see a lot of people sitting around arguing about stuff. I mean, it's just very different. Can we get better? Yes. Do we still go to boot camp, and do young men and women at Parris Island and San Diego, do they get stressed and do they get tested? Do they earn the title Marine? Do they earn the right to have this EGA on their collar? Absolutely. No question. So, yeah, we can always get better, but I wouldn't trade today's Marine Corps for anything.
You know, on the future of that force, one thing we hadn't talked about is women and the progress in the last year and a half or so, 2 years, into infantry, into officer level. What's the state now, and what are you hearing from the different women's groups or veterans groups about that progress?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. I think since the decision was made to, there were two things that happened. You got to remember, there was the assignment of women to previously restricted units. Mm-hmm. And they were assigned women to previously restricted MOSs. So on the first one, I mean, there's like close to 900 women in the three divisions. They're Marines, do their job. The number of women in ground combat MOSs is smaller. There are some that say that the progress isn't fast enough, but we have no quota. I mean, if you are a Marine and you meet the standard and you want to compete for that MOS, and you make the standard, then you get assigned to that unit. Same thing for an officer. So the numbers, as we expected, I mean, it's not even been 2 years. Mm-hmm. They're small. It's going to take time. And so I don't check on it. I mean, there are some units I know, I mean, there are only right now three infantry battalions that have ground combat arms females. But, you know, when I talk, I mean, they're like every other Marine. Some of them are really good. Most of them are in the middle. And then some of them, like men, some of them have a hard time. So, I mean, it's not anything I really worry about.
What effect has it had on recruiting or women signing up or wanting to come into the Corps?
You know, we've made our numbers, and we've been fortunate that our recruiters work really, really, really hard. I haven't seen, you know, where our goal was to try to get 10% of the force to be women. I think we're closing on 9. I thought we would go, you know, we've marketed our advertising, we've done some things to recruit women. We're doing a lot better with women officers than we are with enlisted. I mean, the number of female officers at OCS this last time, I think, was like 13-14%. So I think we're going to go probably faster there. But I haven't, you know, I can tell you the fact is that for a recruiter to find a qualified and willing applicant, that's a woman or a man, it takes about twice the number of contacts to find to get a female as it does to take a male.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, so they're out there working it. And I mean, the women we have in the Marine Corps are not back to Marine Duckworth over here. They're different than what he remembers. They're very, very capable. And so, I mean, they're Marines. They do their job.
All right, we're within the last 2 minutes. In the far corner, we had a persistent hand. That might be our last question.
Hi, Ben Berliner with defense publication Warrior Maven. Could you speak on the creation of the cyberspace occupational field and the importance of fostering cyber readiness within the Marine Corps?
So when the Cybercom became a separate combatant command, or when they were going through the process of making it such, I think we all realized this would have been 7 years ago, 8 years ago, that this was going to be an area where we needed to grow the Marine Corps. All the services were directed to create a component. All the services were told their component was going to support a certain functional or geographical combatant command. That number, initial number, was way low. And so as we formed this force and we developed this force, the numbers have gone up and we've gotten other taskings. And so I think we realized that the same manpower model that we use for other MOSs was not going to work, because in order to be qualified to do this, you had to go through a certain level of training, and it took time, and it wasn't something that a very junior 18, 19-year-old Marine out of high school was going to be able to do, and you had to have an older, more seasoned person. And we had our radio battalions that we used as kind of the base for this. And then we realized if you spend all this time, it's kind of the SOCOM model. I spent all this time, I've gotten somebody who's a little more experienced. I spent all this time and money and effort, and I put them in there, and then to pull them out in 3 years to have them go do something else just wasn't a cost-effective way. And so in discussions, we said, all right, look, I mean, it's like going to MARSOC. Once you're in, we're done. And talking to the Marines that are in this, I mean, that's the one thing we can give them. I can't pay them what they're worth. And, I mean, we can't compete with the industry. We can't compete with you. I mean, these are really, really smart, capable Marines. But the only thing I could give them that they asked is that might make them stay is that they, hey, look, I really like what I'm doing. I really feel like I'm making a difference. Just let me do this. And our answer was, okay, go do it. I'll leave you alone. Unless you want to leave, if you want to go be a drill instructor, or you want to be a recruiter, or you need a break, or you want to do something different, fine. But otherwise, so that was the idea behind the MOS. So once you get in and you make all the quals, you're in. And you can go do your job. And then we just got to figure out how to figure out a way to pay them or promote them to a senior enough. I mean, this is not PFC Lance Corporal business. This is sergeant, staff sergeant, warrant officer, limited duty officer stuff. And so that's kind of was the design behind it. And we'll have to, it's going to take us a while to get to the numbers. I mean, and we're, I think even on the officer side, just like you sign up to in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marine Corps to be a pilot. Say, I want to be a pilot. You take the test, you go to school, and then you get to the point where you get your wings, and then now we start the clock. Okay, you know, now you owe us eight. The clock doesn't start till you get your wings. It's going to be the same thing with cyber. Hey, I want to go do cyber. Okay. You get a cyber guarantee. You go through the training. You get your equivalent of your cyber quals. Now we start the clock. Because we need those folks, and we're gonna put forth the effort to train them, and the expenditure to train them. We need to get a return on investment.
General, we're past our time, so I'll give you the commander's discretion of how long you want to talk to wrap us up. But I'll lead you in one path to say, you know, thank you for doing this, for coming on stage, for coming before the cameras. You have a captive audience in this room and through these cameras and in this town. When you talk to Congress, when you talk to the public, what do you want from them? What does the Marine Corps need for the future going ahead?
I mean, I've been doing this a while, as was mentioned, and I've seen great changes, and I think we're, you know, we have things we need to work on, things we need to get better on, and I think the American people should have a high expectation of their force, but that force comes from the nation. I mean, we need the young men and women, the sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters and nieces and nephews to still be willing to stick their hand up in the air and serve their country. Because if we get good people, the rest of this stuff will kind of sort itself out. I mean, that's the same about any organization. It starts with the people and ends with the people. But, you know, we're a volunteer force. Actually, more accurately, we're all recruited force. We're expensive. And so, and I know it's a lot of money, but we're in a peer competition. There are those out there that would like to be able to impose their will or at least get their interest advantage over those of the United States. And part of the way you keep that from happening is you have a capable and ready military. And so all I can tell you is that whatever resources we get, you're going to get the best Marine Corps that we can create with the best people that we can recruit from the citizenry of this nation. I mean, this isn't my Marine Corps, it's not your Marine Corps, it's not his Marine Corps, it's our Marine Corps. I mean, a guy told me one day, he said, don't ever say my Marines. So they're not yours, they belong to the United States. He's right. They're your Marines. Our Marines. Not mine. The only thing is mine is if we screw up. I've had a couple of those. But that's mine. But you ask me, that's what I tell the sergeants. Okay, if we screw up, that's mine. I advocate for you. And I'd rather advocate about all the great stuff you're doing. So help me out. Help me out the best of your ability. But I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you to the Atlantic Council. Thank you to the Marine Corps for lending us Commandant General Miller. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.